On this week's Off Mic with Michael Puente, we'll take a quick look at the proposed $26 billion settlement between several pharmaceutical companies and 15 states, including Indiana. We'll also have a glimpse at what the opioid crisis means for one local police department. The opioid crisis may have unintended effects for chronic pain sufferers, as we'll hear from one guest. We'll also talk with a local parent following a years-long ordeal as she watched her son struggle. How do we help our loved ones who need help navigating a complicated mental health system? We'll also visit with a psychiatrist and author who says we become a quick fix culture and offers direction in making sure we get the proper care for mental health issues. We'll finish off with a look at this year's Gary International Black Film Festival going into its 11th year. All of this coming up on Off Mic. And welcome to Off Mic. I'm Michael Gonzalez, and I'm in for Michael Puente. Last month, we heard of a $26 billion settlement, between four pharmaceutical companies that manufacture or market opioid-based medications and 15 states, including Indiana. So Indiana could be in line for more than $500 million as part of this settlement, but there's, of course, a catch. The state has to get as many local governments to sign on to the settlement as possible. But many local governments refuse. They've signed on with other lawsuits, or they're pursuing their own lawsuits, hoping for a better outcomes. So it could, according to some media reports, get down to about $260 million by the time it's all said and done, depending on what those local governments do. Whatever the amount, the appropriations bill that was passed recently has 15% of that settlement money would go to the state, 15% goes to local governments. Their amounts will depend on their population size. And 15% would go to family and social services for statewide treatment and education prevention. So I reached out to Indiana Attorney General Todd Rokita's office through a series of emails. They did not agree to come on the show, nor have they provided a statement. But one thing is clear. On a local level, the opioid crisis is real. Several local police chiefs have told me that they've seen opioid overdoses and abuse sort of level off or stay the same as before the COVID-19 pandemic, while others have told me that it's been a significant increase. Portage Police Chief Michael Candiano, for example, who couldn't join us this morning, but he says that's not the case in his city, that his numbers are up. So his police officers administered naloxone, that's an emergency medication to stop drug overdoses, 34 times between April of last year and this year. Keep in mind, of course, that that's when they were able to react in time to somebody in crisis. His department has already recorded 59 overdoses this year to date, a number he says is probably lower than the actual number of occurrences. So Chief Candiano, also, who was a school resource officer, kind of broke it down for me. This problem, this opioid crisis really begins with even younger kids who find access to opioid-based prescription pills, and unfortunately, too many of them will tend to move towards heroin as they get older. And of course, Chief Candiano said there is a direct correlation between crime and drug use, a really high percentage. If you remove crimes of passion, crimes that are driven by drug use or drug addiction are a very, very significant number of the number of crimes that are reported. That's just a glimpse. There's so much more to unpack here, and hopefully we'll revisit this another time. But for now, let's take a little break. When we come back, we're going to be with guest Linda Rollins. We're going to see another side of this opioid crisis that many of us may not have even considered. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Off Mic. I'm Michael Gonzalez. As I said a moment ago, this opioid crisis that we've been discussing, it takes a number of forms. You see it in many different ways, from individuals who may zone out or fall asleep in drive-thrus or on the street, to pill mills, medical offices with long lines of people that are eager to get in and get their prescriptions for opioid-based medications. But what if? What if the valid concerns about access to opioids for chronic pain sufferers, for example, What if this crisis is affecting them, and how is it affecting them if it is? So my guest, Linda Rollins, says she and other chronic pain patients are suffering more now because medical professionals have reduced or in some cases cut out their opioid-based medications as a result of the fear generated by the opioid crisis and some recommendations by leading agencies. Linda Rollins, welcome to Off Mic.
Thank you, Mike, and thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. So briefly tell us a little bit about yourself, Linda, and the pain issues that got you to this point in the discussion.
Okay. I have CRPS, which is complex regional pain syndrome. I was on opioid pain medication that was working for me. And in 2016, the CDC dropped guidelines for recommendations for opioid prescribing, and they suggested 90 MMEs. Since then, they have force tapered. I don't have much of my pain medicine left. So what we have now is we have two sets of doctors, one set that is trying to treat their pain patients and are now being raided and arrested, and we have another set of doctors that see the value in forcing modalities like spinal cord stimulators. I have my second spinal cord stimulator in right now. My first one that they put in was on recall, so I will never know if a spinal cord stimulator could have or would have worked for me. There were really bad things happening to me. I got zapped one time. I fell. I fractured my left arm. Another time I fell, I fractured my nose. After almost a year, I get a letter saying it was on recall. So pain patients are going through all of the modalities that they are suggesting. And now with my second one, they're trying to make me remove the second one and put in the third. I'm not having it anymore. I know what that means. I'm going to lose what I have left of my pain medicine, but I can't do this anymore. So spinal cord stimulators have become a market, and what they're not talking about is how they can harm people.
Well, let's come back to some of these alternatives in just a moment, because I know that we've discussed that before, but I want to hit that again in just a moment, because what I'm finding and what I've noticed is that chronic pain sufferers are becoming more vocal about this issue. They're sort of getting together and talking to more people and talking out loud about their pain medication issues and the cutback and the amount of opiates in their pain medication. When you think in terms of other people in the same boat as you, what do you hope to achieve by speaking out or by drawing attention? What's the value of that for you?
The value of that is it's time to get the DEA and the government out from between the patient and the doctors. The patients deserve to have their doctors back. These doctors once were respected. People traveled miles to go see specialists. Now if you go into another state, you're flagged for doctor hopping. People are committing suicide. I don't care if anybody doesn't see a problem with that. You're on the wrong side of the fence.
So I know that you mentioned 2016. So several years ago, the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued guidelines, as you mentioned, to medical professionals who prescribe opioid-based medications. And some of those recommendations included promoting non-opioid or non-pharmacologic therapies for chronic pain. They also sort of reminded prescribers that opiates are not the first line or routine therapy for chronic pain. So they recommended sort of things like immediate-release opioids instead of extended-release and some other types of non-pharmacological ideas. So what are your concerns with the way medical professionals have reacted to those CDC recommendations, such as cutting back the opiate levels, et cetera? Tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, they keep talking about other modalities, other things, but what nobody's mentioning is pain patients have been through those modalities, and now they're recommending pain patients are subjecting themselves to injections, which were never recommended to be injected the way that they are. You know, we heard about how these injections deteriorated your bone and everything else.
I'm sorry, Linda, but injections of what?
Steroids.
Okay.
You know, we're going through, they're back to recommending injections like sympathetic blocks, nerve blocks. We've had those modalities. You know, when I speak, I'm not speaking for myself. These people had a quality of life. These people worked. Most pain patients will do anything they can to be fixed, to understand, to how to get back to the way their life were. before they start taking opioid pain medication.
But you do, but you can understand the concern, I'm sure, that when you see news headlines of pill mills or when you see overdoses, this is going to generate a lot of concern. You can accept that portion of it, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We have a clear addiction crisis. There's no getting around it. We are in the middle of a crisis. But this has gone on for a very long time, and they're going at it the wrong way. When they started taking my medicine, I was very angry, and I decided, okay, I have to understand how did my life intersect with addicts. So I started working with addicts, and I was driving 3.5 to 4 hours away to get them in treatment. If an addict wants to get high, they're going to get high.
So one of the things, a friend of yours, Dawn Anderson, was also very vocal on this issue. She's no longer with us. Quickly, briefly, I guess, tell us what happened to Dawn.
Dawn and I advocated together. We were together every day of the week, pretty much, fighting for pain patients. And then I found myself on the phone with my best friend begging her not to die. But she didn't see any other recourse. You know, Dawn was a double amputee. She had one eye. But I'm going to tell you what, she had the voice of many. And my best friend has now fallen victim to this war on patients.
So
she's no longer with us. She committed suicide. We can't fix that. For the lives that we've lost, we can't take that back.
So
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Finish, please.
We have people, cancer patients, that are in end-stage cancer, that are on palliative care, that can't even get pain medicine.
Linda Rollins, thank you for joining us. We have to leave it at that. We have to go on. But again, thank you for joining us. And we'll be back for more Off Mic.
Thank you, Mike.
Welcome back, everyone, to Off Mic. I am Michael Gonzalez, filling in for Michael Puente. Emma's House in Gary is a ministry of the City of Refuge Christian Church of Northwest Indiana. Emma's House provides a safe place, shelter, and services to homeless women, many of whom struggle with substance abuse disorders. Pastor Michael Pirtle is joining us. He's a licensed substance abuse counselor, and he and his wife started Emma's House. Pastor Pirtle, welcome to Off Mic.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Oh, thank you for joining us. So tell us a little bit more about Emma's House. And by the way, did I get that correct, licensed substance abuse counselor?
Yes, I am a licensed clinical addiction counselor. I have a master's degree in addiction counseling. I've also been a director of opioid methadone clinic there at Edgewater in Gary.
So you have that frontline knowledge.
Yes.
So tell us more about Emma's House and when and why you started Emma's House.
Well, we started Emma's House about 4 years ago, Mike. Our ministry have always done outreaches to people that was in the work release or coming out of jail. And there was a Roderick Threat that had a home that he would rather donate to us than to just let it go down. And so Roderick had given us a home, and the first thing that came to our mind was, hey, we need to find a place where we can put women that are struggling, i.e. either with legal issues or substance use disorders. And so that's how Emma House was birthed. And the name Emma is actually Roderick's mother. Her name was Emma Threat. She built that home, so we just named it in honor of her. We have been operating for 4 years now, and we have seen some level of success in helping women that would come through that home. And my heart goes out to your previous guest and her issue. But we've seen some great strides here. And I want to thank the state of Indiana, Mike, because in 2018, they passed an opioid response grant for $17,884,200. And Emma House actually is a recipient of a portion of that money. And so we're actually able to house women that are struggling with opioid use disorders, as well as referring them to treatment facilities to get treatment. And if they need medication-assisted treatment like methadone, Vivitrol, Suboxone, we actually allow our residents to participate in those programs to aid them in their sobriety.
So, Pastor Pearls, how many beds are in there, by the way? How many women can you accommodate in a given time?
We can accommodate 10 women at any given time. We currently have 3 women there now receiving services.
Now, when you look at your experience, especially over the past several years, I mean, obviously the opioid crisis has been big news for a while, and you've been on the front lines of that. But even there at Emma House, are you seeing an increase or a decrease? Tell me about the flow of clients that are coming to Emma's House.
Well, we've had quite a few residents come through with an opioid use disorder, specifically those that drug of choice is heroin. We've definitely seen an increase with that population of women coming through Emma House. But I'm so happy to say, though, the local community mental health facilities like Edgewater or and other facilities offer amazing programs to help these women if they want to be helped.
Now, based on your experience, and you've been in this business for a while, I mean, you understand it. What are the signs when a woman comes to you? What are the signs that she is struggling with a substance abuse disorder?
Well, they're very impulsive, impulsivity. They can be very demanding, not really goal oriented, just trying to get through the day. Very manipulative, on a whole lot of levels, display anxiety, and many of them are medication seeking, you know, and so they'll try to find some type of way to, if they can't have their drug of choice, some kind of way to find something that's going to alleviate their need for the drug.
So those can be pretty dramatic signs.
Yes.
What does recovery look like for them?
Well, recovery is when, you know, these women want to get their life back. And number one that we highly emphasize at Emma House is to reestablish some level of structure, some level of pursuing not a 5-year goal, but what's your goal for the next week? Because many people struggling with addictions and don't live for next week. They're just living for today. Mm-hmm. And so we try to reestablish some type of life goals with these women and get them to a place where they're following some type of systematic programming on a day-to-day basis.
Tell me about a time when a woman came back and thanked you or told you and your team about what that recovery has meant for her.
Well, that's interesting. We had a young lady yesterday just leave to move to Virginia, which is now Merritt, and relocating to another state and doing very well. Mike, I must say that we've had a lot of ladies come back and say thank you down the road, but while going through the recovery process, did not appreciate it. Hmm. Because they was held accountable, and so many of them would get really upset and irritated with us based off of structure, but then later would come back and say, I really appreciate it.
So, Pastor Pirtle, one last thing. What's next for Emma's House?
Well, Emma House is definitely alive and well. Under the Emma House umbrella, there's another approach that we have now called a recovery cafe where, you know, yeah, you're in treatment. You may even have medication-assisted treatment, but are you changing your people, places, and things? And the Recovery Cafe is giving them activities and things to do during the day, things that can occupy their time. It's an environment where they can continually be supported instead of being in an environment that's going to trigger them for continued use or maladaptive behaviors or behaviors that's not going to serve them very well. And so I'm happy to say that there are other resources and areas that's coming for Emma House. And, Mike, I also want to say this. The state of Indiana is doing an amazing job. They sent me over 20 backpacks the other day, and in each backpack there is some Narcan. And that Narcan is available, and it is not a permission to use drugs, but it is a resource in case they're in an environment, whether they have used or they're around somebody that's used, they got this Narcan readily available that they can spray into the nasal passage of someone that have OD'd to revive them. And so we also equip our women with Narcan.
All right. Well, Pastor Michael Pirtle, thank you very much for joining us on Off Mic.
I appreciate you having me.
It's a pleasure having you. And we'll be right back after this. And welcome back to Off Mic. I'm Michael Gonzalez. We've been talking a little bit about various aspects of what we've been calling the opioid crisis, or what's commonly called the opioid crisis. But there's a lot more to consider. There's so many more issues that we can touch on. For example, how do we help our loved ones who are facing the side effects, or even ourselves, but who are facing the side effects of taking any number of medications, and some of them with really strong side effects? What's our responsibility for our care as patients, or our loved ones as our patients? And what are the medical professionals' responsibilities? These are really, really big questions, but they always affect us at a very local level. So I'm joined now by Heather McCarthy. Heather McCarthy is a mom and an attorney. She spent years dealing with her son O'Shea's medical treatment and care providers, and it's a very difficult story. We're also joined by Dr. David Healy, a psychiatrist and author, hundreds of peer-reviewed articles in books like Pharmageddon, Shipwreck of the Singular, Children of the Care, Heather McCarthy and David Healy, welcome to Off Mic.
Hi, Mike. It's good to be here.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for having us on today.
I'm glad to have you. So Heather, in 2011, just before nasal surgery, as he was preparing to attend Purdue University, your son Patrick, O'Shea Patrick McCarthy, is his full name.
He goes by Shay.
Shay was prescribed a very strong antibiotic, which was known to have some very serious side effects, Levaquin.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
A short time later, because of side effects of those medications, Shay sought mental health treatment for some of those side effects. Mm-hmm. And that led Shay and your family through a years-long path, mm-hmm. just this frightening path, that only recently came to a conclusion with a legal action that we're not really going to go into at this point, because we have a lot of other things.
I just to clarify, it came to conclusion with his death. The legal action, came after that.
Thank you. So, Heather McCarthy, tell us about Shay before all of this began.
Mm-hmm. Well, Shay was a very, very bright young man, very smart. He was a gifted artist, musician. He got accepted into Purdue, the Earth and Atmospheric Science Program, very interested in science, attended 1 year, and then, as you mentioned, he had always had trouble with his nose, runny nose, this and that. So we decided that we would have the surgery done for a deviated septum. In having that surgery, his attending physician for that prescribed him a very, very large dose of a class of antibiotics or fluoroquinolones, Levaquin, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And they come with a variety of risk, adverse effects that could happen to people taking them. And he was just giving them to kind of make this very clear as a preventative measure. He had no infection, nothing. And even when they're used now, some of your viewers might have been familiar, have taken Levaquin, Cipro, usually get them a day or two. He was given a prescription for 21 days at a very high dose, and then it was actually refilled for a second dose. We know he took it about 20 days. But after that surgery, while he was taking it, he did not feel right. He complained about it. Following healing from that surgery, he went through a progression of just numerous horrific side effects for him: panic attacks, heart palpitations, just nervousness, insomnia. By the fall of the spring of the year after his surgery, which was the summer, he was a sophomore at college, just really was having trouble even going to school. Just, we didn't know what was going on. He attributed a lot of these symptoms he was having to the drug, and we certainly encouraged him to tell his doctors, tell, you know, everyone. Now we know in hindsight, after looking at his treatment records, he certainly did tell them. These particular effects from this class of drugs has been known for a very long time. It doesn't take that long to Google it and see that. There has been, since his death, several black box warnings that have been added to this class of drugs.
And tell us about what that means, a black box warning.
Well, it's the highest warning on a, you would think your attending physician or someone treating you would be aware of that, and I'm sure Dr. Healy could speak more, but it's the highest warning that's showcased on the labeling that the FDA would mandate needs to be on there. So, you know, when physicians, which they should be, are giving patients informed consent, which means telling us as patients when we are going to be given a treatment or making a decision as to it, whether, you know, the benefits of that treatment outweigh the risk. And a lot of the conditions my son was experiencing were certainly known side effects of this drug. They are more prominent on the labeling now. But there was really, although he was very clear in associating his condition with this particular drug, it really wasn't followed up.
Well, and what strikes me, as you and I have talked a couple of times, is that all throughout that time, Shea had a presence of mind. He had a self-awareness to attribute problems, right? To say, these are side effects, I'm having this issue, and being able to attribute it to this particular drug, et cetera. So there's was that part of his character, would you think?
A very strong, insightful. I think he knew himself very well, and he knew this. But that, I believe, is what breaks my heart even more. Because if you can imagine experiencing some of these side effects, high anxiety, you know, not being able to sleep, moving into depression, being so anxious you can't be in public, and being aware of the cause of it and telling people about it and telling his healthcare providers about it and it being ignored. I think that is probably just the most devastating thing for him, because I know he was scared and I know he wanted to get better. And we believed and trusted the doctors treating him that even he was diagnosed with bipolar. They thought he had bipolar. Mm-hmm. We believe that was the wrong diagnosis. He did not have the indications of bipolar. But even with that, and, you know, being given then numerous medications for that, when you have a young man who's obviously shown sensitivities to some of these drugs or treatments that the doctors were prescribing, to not improve, to not show any signs of improvement and continue on that course of action is just unacceptable. And I think that's why it's important. Yes, there is a opioid epidemic, but there's a prescribing epidemic right now.
As well.
And we need to talk about that, because I think a lot of families, perhaps I know they have now that I've spoken to so many people on this topic, but a lot of them even experience what we did and still can't pinpoint what it is. You know, did it come from a drug? Is this mental illness? What is happening here? And I think that's why it's so important that stories like these are heard. Because this was just devastating, and Shay's deterioration was slow. We lost him very slowly. His life ended when he drove his car into a cement embankment. He was on a host of drugs that weren't monitored properly. It's clear to me that was the case, since what I believe to be. And what often happens in these situations is, especially when you enter into the mental health system in this country, is that it's hard to distinguish what symptoms you're having are effect of the drug you're taking. You talked about opioids today. You know, there's benzos. A lot of times psychotropic drugs cause anxiety issues, which are then The patient is directed to mask them with a benzodiazepine, which is also very addictive.
One on top of another.
Yeah. So you're never getting to the source. And I can let, you know, Dr. Healy talk to that more. But I know in my son's case, I think he just got tired. He was telling everyone. We're telling him to tell his doctors. His compliance with his treatment, I believe, is what caused his death.
And I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. My condolences. Let me switch over to Dr. Healy. Dr. Healy, there are so many issues involved. But how do we, as patients or as loved ones of patients, how do we take care of ourselves and our loved ones? How, when we go into a medical situation or a mental health situation like this, we trust our doctors. We trust our medical professionals. How do we handle this? How do we know that they're giving us the right care?
We don't really know, and I think we've got a growing problem. I think things are actually getting worse, and my hope is that programs like this are going to alert people to the question you've just asked and to recognize that we don't have an answer at the moment and that we need to find one. Shay's case was absolutely typical of what's happening across the board. You've got a young, awfully bright man who told the doctors what the diagnosis was, and they didn't see or hear him. He complained about being edgy and anxious and out of sorts, and maybe used words about it, like being anxious and being depressed. And they said, oh, well, we have pills for that. And they gave him pills for that, not recognizing that he'd been poisoned, as it were, by the prior treatment. The Lavaquin that he'd been put on was the thing that was causing the problem. Now, when I say poisoned, if you take a drug that doesn't suit you, it's a bit like having COVID maybe or the flu or whatever. If you're physically compromised, you'll feel anxious, you'll feel depressed. If we knew you had COVID, we wouldn't give you an antidepressant for being just that bit low and out of sorts. We wouldn't put you on pills to treat you for being anxious, just when you have that kind of nervous tension or muscular tension that can go with an illness like that. But that's what the doctors did in this case. And things got even worse because the pills they put him on caused their own problems, and they didn't recognize that what was happening here was that he was having a poor reaction to them, and that the trick should have been to change the pills. They kept him on the same pills for years and years and years without changing anything. And it was the inflexibility, the failure to listen to him and see what was happening to him and see the very visible changes in him over the course of a year or two that should have alerted them. In older days when, you know, we used to talk about person-centered care, we assumed when you came into the doctor that you saw the same person each time and they could see you and see the change in you. Now, Shay did see the same few people the whole time, but they must have been looking at the computer and not looking at him because they didn't see the very visible changes that you can see in the photographs of him since. And that's the problem we've got. And the extra problem is when things like this go wrong, and even before it gets to the point where you have a person who's dead, where you have a son or a daughter or a parent or whatever who's actually been killed by treatment, even before that, if you try and raise these issues with the system, you find that they don't respond. They invariably say, well, we're keeping to the guidelines, and they can, in perhaps Shay's case, for instance, they'll say, well, he was anxious, he's talking about being depressed, we have him on treatment for this, we've kept the guidelines, we've ticked the box. And well, it's awfully hard for any of us to break through this.
Well, that was my next question. Recently. My next question, Doctor, actually, you fed right into my next question, because this happens, and if you're describing Shay's case as typical, then that means this is relatively common, a problem, common incident, situation. Really quickly, with the remaining time we have, what should we do? Give us a couple of tools that would help us if we find ourselves in this situation. How do we act at that point?
It's awfully hard to know just what we need to do, and I think it needs a good deal of thought. Let me put it like this to you. I have a lady whose daughter was put on one of these drugs recently, and she went on and killed herself. And she said, you know, I wish she was murdered. because if she was murdered, I'd be able to face the perpetrator in court. The problem with prescription drugs we've got is that you find the system somehow finds that it's ticked all of the boxes, that you don't have a case, that there's no way to get through to it, there's no way to get them to listen, even after death. But ideally, we want to get them to listen before that, and they're not. They aren't listening in the way that they used to. If you're talking about an opioid or a street drug, people will say, yes, for sure, if you're harmed by this drug, that the drug clearly harmed you. If you go and talk to a doctor about being harmed by a prescription drug, they won't concede that the drug is actually causing the harm.
This is very concerning.
It's very concerning. And let's not forget that the opioid crisis or epidemic, whatever you want to call it, started with prescriptions. You had a lot of people prescribe these drugs, and then those were removed. But yes, it's very disturbing. I can tell you, it's been horrific for my family, and that's why it's so important for me to speak out. One of the things that was really helpful in my situation was finding Dr. Healy, and not only that, he has. And when you ask what can people do, a website, organization RISK.org,
and that's RXISK.
That's correct.
All right. So, with a little bit of time that we have remaining, Heather McCarthy, what's your next step? I know you're going to continue telling Shay's story. I know you're going to get the word out. What's your next step?
Well, my next step, I mean, I have been focused for the past 8 years on bringing a lawsuit because that's one of the ways to get the attention of physicians to say, look, there has to be some accountability and consequence to this. There's a young man who's dead because of these oversights and this inability to recognize, the complete destructive nature of the treatment they were providing him. So I think now, I've been involved in litigation, which did not allow me to speak about it. We did reach a settlement, and surprisingly, I have no restrictions on what I can and cannot say.
Quite surprisingly.
Which I think goes to show you there are issues here.
But there's also a book in the works. Are you considering?
Possibly.
All right.
Possibly.
Well, Heather McCarthy, takes a tremendous amount of courage and strength to speak like this. So thank you for joining us as well. Dr. Healy, thank you for joining us on Off Mic.
Great. Okay. Thanks a lot.
We're taking a little break. We'll be back with more Off Mic. Welcome back to Off Mic. I'm Michael Gonzalez, filling in again for Michael Puente. The Gary International Black Film Festival is celebrating its 11th year. Amazing. I've been pleased to follow this for years, this year is a little bit different. Posed some interesting challenges this year. We're talking now with Gary native Karen Toring, and also with Walter Jones, festival founders and organizers. Karen and Walter, welcome to Off Mic.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you both. So, Karen Toring, it's pretty amazing feat holding a festival like this for this long. What's the secret of success?
I think it's the relationships that the Gary team has with each other. We are all, sort of lifelong friends and connected. A couple of us went to the same high school. Walter Jones, our board chair, who's also joining us today, is the outlier. He went to Lew Wallace.
Ooh.
It's okay, Mr. Jones.
That was well.
So you have this connection, and it shows. It shows in the longevity. It shows in the success. So, Walter Jones, as the years have gone by, have we changed the way we view film as an art form?
In a personal sense or a community sense?
Both.
I guess
as both.
In a personal sense, I definitely have been drawn to it more. I'm more of a verbal storyteller, and just the power of adding the video portion, which is film, makes any story that much more powerful. And if you're talking more on a community level, I think that the more the community is able to interact with film and the discussions that can come out of it really make people more interested in viewing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, And I'm a big fan of stories, so yeah, I'm with you on that. So, Karen Toring, when is the festival, and what can we expect this year?
This year's festival is October 8th, 9th, and 10th. It will be anchored at Indiana University, but, you know, with the latest pandemic, we are doing what we call, and certainly in the festival circuit, call a hybrid.
A hybrid, okay.
Yes, which means there will be some films that are available online and some films that aren't available in person. And, you know, COVID and the Delta variant are, you know, certainly impacting our, you know, our decisions around the festival. So we want to make sure that people can enjoy the festival at their comfort level.
And so there'll be online, in person. What about a face mask mandate? Will there be a mask mandate?
Well, we are, as we have been for the last 10 years, hosted at Indiana University Northwest. And so we will be expecting that folks will follow the Indiana
Fair
University
enough.
COVID protocol.
Fair enough. So Walter Jones is the board chair. I'd asked you before about film as an art form. You talked about yourself personally. What do people in the community tell you about this festival?
Well, one of the most we hate to hear is that, yeah, we know it, we love it, but we haven't been there yet.
Followed closely by, we didn't know that Gary had a Black Film Festival.
Huh.
Those are the two most. The two most common responses that we hear, even though we've been around for 11 years.
And you, not only have you been around, you've brought great films and you've brought in filmmakers. You've brought in all kinds of personalities.
We have. We've had everyone from Ava DuVernay
right.
to Robert Townsend to filmmakers that are, you know, very, very new to the filmmaking game, but have incredible works of art. We've been very lucky, and we've built really good relationships.
So your favorite, and that's the thing. When you bring in filmmakers, that tells me that they know how important this is. Is it possible, Walter Jones, for you to pick out a favorite moment to date?
Ooh, to date, it would have been 2019, and we had a documentary of Gary's own, Sin City Disciples.
Mm-hmm.
And on that occasion, the entire, what would you call it, concourse area of Savannah Hall was totally full of people waiting to enjoy good film.
Hmm.
Yeah, that was a really great, and you know, they even had like a Hell's Angels chapter that joined the screening that day. That was a pretty incredible day.
That would be incredible. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, there were more colors, I'm just going to call them, represented. Than, you know, Karen mentioned the Hell's Angels, but I think we had about five or six at least. Motorcycle clubs who came.
Interesting time. So, Karen Toring, really quickly, a little bit less than a minute. What was your favorite moment?
They're all my favorites, but I think it was when Robert Townsend came to Indiana University and worked with educators to build, sort of a coalition and discussion series around education, secondary education.
That was a great moment.
Of course, my very, very, very favorite moment was the first film that we ever showed at the festival with Ava DuVernay.
I remember.
Before Ava DuVernay was Ava DuVernay. You were there, Mike.
And by the way, one of the movies that's most disturbed me in my life, and I'm drawing a blank on the name, is Saeed Morales was in it. That movie shook me to my core, so I knew it was positive. So we have to wrap up. Shout out, by the way, to Toni Simpson, the amazing Toni Simpson, for all of her work in this. Karen Toring and Walter Jones, thank you so much for joining us on Off Mic.
Thanks again, Toni Simpson, and thanks, Mike, for having us.
Absolutely, and best of luck to you this year. So that's all for today. So special thank you to all of our guests for taking time out to join us. Thank you for listening. All of you for listening. Thank you to Michael Puente for allowing me to pitch in. And a big, gigantic thank you to the amazing Dee Dodson for being such a huge help. You can hear this program again on lakeshorepublicradio.org or on the NPR app, and have an excellent weekend.